Welcome to the podcast of the Geological Society. In this episode, independent scientist James Lovelock and evolutionary biologist Lynn Margulis talk about the origins of the Gaia hypothesis. Better known now as Earth System Science, the concept of the Earth as an indivisible system brings together Earth and life sciences and was the subject of a conference held at the Geological Society in May. Through interviews as well as audio recordings from the conference, James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis talk about their early collaboration and the relevance of Gaia today.
Back in 1960, geology was still mainly about the rocks and the sediments. Biology was pretty well fully occupied, apart from the work Lynn was doing, with neo-Darwinism. And any discussions that occurred between the earth and life scientists, for example, out in that courtyard, were quite friendly, but they were nearly all about where to find the best fossils. There was very little else that was exchanged. The academic world continued in its steady way to teach earth and life sciences quite separately, as they always had done. By the start of this century, of course, our view of the earth was vastly changed, and the use of the word revolution, I think, is quite a good one here. It is a revolution. It was the human and instrumental view of the Earth and the planets from space that opened our minds and let us see that the Earth was indeed a dynamic system, the system that James Hutton had envisaged more than 200 years ago. We were all filled with wonder by those first ever views of the planet from outside, and we owe an immense debt to NASA for having provided us with the spaceship in which we would take the steps beyond Darwin and recognise that evolution by natural selection is a property of the whole planetary system, and not just of the organisms alone. The odd and unstable atmosphere that we breathe requires a presence on the Earth's surface of something that can synthesise continuously quite huge quantities of both oxygen and carbon dioxide, and also remove equally large quantities of these gases. It is, of course, the biota. And living organisms must also recycle and produce in large quantities the methane, nitrogen, and most of the other trace gases. In other words, this atmosphere here is almost entirely a biological product. Much more than this, the climate is very sensitive to the abundance of polyatomic gases like methane, nitrous oxide, and CO2. And very small changes, as we well know, in the abundance of those gases can make a big difference to climate. These facts in 1965 led me to suggest the concept of life regulating the climate and chemistry of the Earth, and that some means is needed for regulating the atmospheric composition if the Earth is to remain habitable as a planet, because quite clearly the other planets, which must represent the norm, are far from habitable by anything that one can envisage. Because this concept was a bit wild in many ways and regarded as flaky, I think, at first, I badly needed a succinct and memorable name to encompass the ideas of life, the Earth, and self-regulation. And sometime in 1969, a near neighbour of mine, the Nobel Prize-winning author William Golding, who incidentally was also a physicist as well as a novelist, suggested that I call the idea Gaia after the ancient Greek name of the goddess of the Earth. I had by now the bare bones of a hypothesis about our planet as a system that somehow kept its climate and chemistry favourable for life. I knew that life on Earth must be deeply involved, but it was not until 1971 that I had the chance to discuss the topic with a distinguished biologist. You see, the biologists at JPL, for the most part, saw me as a rival, offering a totally different mechanical way of looking for life, and they weren't too happy about discussing the subject in general. It would be fair to say that Lynn put the flesh on the bones of my physiological concept of a living planet.
My name is Lynn Margulis, and even though I have a PhD in genetics, I'm a wannabe geologist. And I'm coming now from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where I'm a distinguished university professor in the Department of Geosciences, so they've accepted me. Very simply, I call myself an evolutionist, and I don't consider it an insult if people call me a natural historian, even though those are supposed to be extinct and dead and so on. But evolutionist is really what I do. I mean, I'm interested in evolution. That makes me interested in both the geological history and the biological history, because it's completely co-evolved.
Mm. And you had quite an important role in the early formation of the Gaia theory.
Well, I don't think so, but they tell me I do. It was very interesting. I was working on relating various lineages of bacteria by their metabolism, and of course it was inevitable that you noticed that the cyanobacteria were oxygenic, they produced oxygen. But I noticed that the nitrate-reducing bacteria would produce the various oxides of nitrogen and nitrogen gas, and that the coliform-type bacteria produced atmospheric-type N2, and that there was a whole lot of sulfate-reducing bacteria that produced hydrogen sulfide. And I think there was, when I finished, there were about 30 gases that were produced on these lineages of bacteria. So I said at various meetings, I was a member of the Space Science Board of the National Academy at the time, and I also was involved with NASA activities. And I asked everybody I knew who I thought might know something, I said, why does everybody say, in this textbook say, that oxygen in the atmosphere is a product of life, which clearly it is, but they don't mention the other 38 gases. They don't mention that nitrogen also, and hydrogen sulfide. And they said, well, you should talk to Lovelock. Who's Lovelock? Well, he's a rich man who lives in the English countryside, and he agrees with you. I said, what do you mean agrees with me? Well, he thinks all the gases you mentioned are a biological product. 8 different people said that to me. And I finally said, well, give me his address, and somebody gave it to me. And I wrote him, and he wrote back saying, oh, thank you for writing me. Do you know of a process that produces methane? I can calculate that in the Earth's atmosphere is way too much methane. I said, of course, there are methanogenic bacteria. They take hydrogen gas and carbon dioxide, and they can live on that alone, and they make methane. And as far as I know, it's methanogenesis, the production of methane gas, is completely a bacterial product. And he said, oh, thank you. I always wondered why. There's too much methane by 10 to the 27th, and that's where the calculations just stopped, because that was enough for the computer. Anyway, that started the whole Gaia discussion. And then he came through and stayed at our house, and we had this conversation, these tapes, and it was like a Wednesday. And we spent 3 hours in the morning and 2 in the afternoon taping this conversation, because I would say, you mean life adapts to its environment? And he'd say, no, that's exactly what I do not mean. Life is influencing its environment. It's responding, and its response has an effect on the environment. Anyway, those days, he was much less articulate about the Gaia hypothesis because he hadn't developed it so well. And you have to use old words. You have to use the words that everybody else uses. So he didn't have a vocabulary like that. And the 10th hour, I began to understand what he was saying. I mean, he was saying such original things, you know. And we decided to write it up. In 1974, we published those 2 papers, one in TELUS, which is an earth science journal, and the other in Icarus, which was the planetary journal. And I was the first author on one, and he was the first author. And so they say that he's the father of the Gaia hypothesis and I'm the mother, but I think that's not right. I mean, he's the father, and after working through and really listening to him and responding to him, I just showed that what he was looking for, he knew what he was looking for. He was looking for these producers of these gases, and I was just reading them off my chart. So to me, the Gaia hypothesis, which may be a theory by now, but anyway, it states that the Earth's atmosphere and surface sediments are actively maintained by metabolism, growth, and many other kinds of interactions of the biota with the surface sediments in the air.
So that it's sort of self-maintained.
It maintains. It's not a self. I don't think it's a self. Many people ridiculed it or characterized it or caricatured that, by saying, oh, they believe that the Earth is an embryo or the Earth is an organism and therefore not science. And Lovelock and I have talked about that. And I say, look, it's not an organism. You can say it's a set of interlocking ecosystems. You can say it's one huge ecosystem. You can't say it's an organism. It is not an organism because there is no organism known that recycles its own waste, that drinks its sweat and eats its feces and so on. It doesn't make any sense. It takes much more than one. It takes diversity. So don't call it an organism. And his answer, bless his heart, was, yeah, of course you're right, but if they think the Earth is a pile of rocks, they have no respect or no sense of preservation or concern for them. If they think the Earth is alive and an organism, it changes immediately the sense. And I said to him, Jim, I agree with your sentiment. I will not call it an organism. I think you don't want to perpetrate sort of mythological half-truths because it just makes the scientists furious. And it makes you vulnerable to criticism. So I don't like that at all. But what they've done in academic circles, which is what this meeting is also in that tradition, is they don't say we're going to have a meeting on the Gaia hypothesis, which we did. We had several of them. It's on Earth system science. Now, the fact is, Earth system science is the Gaia notion. I fought, and I probably lost. Go back to the word Gaia. I mean, that's fine, because Gaia is one unit. The Earth is indivisible. That's the point. Gaia expresses the concept that the Earth is indivisible, and the people, like all the people at this meeting, are very aware of that and very concerned about this, what they call coevolution of the environment and life. So why not call it Gaia? They're afraid to, because it's rejected by the hardcore geologists or physical scientists. Anyway, that's the story. Mm. You now know more than anybody in this meeting about the story of the origin of Gaia.
The Gaia hypothesis was well accepted by atmospheric scientists, and to an extent still is. But after about 1975, Earth and life scientists both began to attack the concept of life regulating the climate and chemistry of the Earth. At first, the criticisms were helpful, as criticisms often are. But the neo-Darwinist biologists, I'm afraid, went a little wild. And began what became a polemic and scathing attack on the hypothesis. This was mainly based on their erroneous idea that the hypothesis was anti-Darwinian, which it isn't. The talented author and debater, Richard Dawkins, disputed Gaia with the same vigour as he subsequently attacked God. This was a formidable opposition to deal with. And it's not surprising that you could not publish a paper with Gaia in the title for many, many years afterwards. The peer reviewers threw it out instantly.
You mentioned sort of opposition to your ideas all the way through from the sort of neo-Darwinist to Richard Dawkins now. Is that still something you come up against?
Oh, yes. It was a very hostile, difficult working on it. And I could never have done it in a university or in a government institution or in a commercial institute. The director would have just called me and say, look, Lovelock, you've got to drop this Gaia stuff. It's just bringing the place a bad reputation. We can't have it. You want to do that, you'll have to leave.
And that's sort of changed now, because it's now something people have a very good opinion of and it's got a really good reputation. What do you think happened to make that transition?
I think that there was an endless attempt to falsify the theory, and it's all failed. It hasn't been falsified, and the evidence from the Earth and from the other planets is now strong enough that it has to be accepted. But it was a grudging process. They didn't want to.
It got well attacked.
Well, I mean, there's nothing new in that. Look at Wegener in with plate tectonics. He had a lot of pretty tough time. One of the reasons that the idea I introduced of a kind of living Earth was not popular, it would have meant the rewriting of geological textbooks, biological textbooks, and everybody resisted that, naturally.
And you think that's something that's still going on, the sort of separation?
No, not so much. No, it's okay. Beginning to be... Science is, how can I put it...
if you're going to look at climate change as something like that, an important topic, you can't just look at it from the point of view of meteorology. You have to start looking at it from geology, biology, everything.
How important do you think Gaian thinking is to tackling those problems in terms of climate and humans?
Well, the approach is the only approach because it's inclusive. It's inclusive of all of the atmospheric chemistry, geology, the biology. I mean, it's inclusive. So that doesn't. But I find it amusing because I spend literally all my scientific time trying to accurately reconstruct the past history of life, which is evolution. I refuse to deal with the future because I know so little even about the past history where the clues are accurate. I would say, on the other hand, do you believe in your own personal death? Do you think you're going to live forever? Or do you think you're going to die? I'm just asking you.
I think I'm going to die.
Oh, I think you have a lot of evidence in that. Yeah, yeah. And I certainly agree with that. I think that it's comparable to personal death. The concept that we have an absolutely invincible sword and we can just do what we want with the earth and not pay any consequences is what is the source of our basic problem, and especially having to do with having more children. People are rational in a very limited way because when it comes to having more children or sexual urges or lying and deception, people are really good at that. And there's this force that will make us leave our habitat and make the sort of the happy habitat for us is up on a hill a little bit so you can see what's coming at you. It's a little bit wooded but not deep forest. It's always near a water supply, either river or the ocean, both. That's the preferred habitat by all the people, and the people will fight like hell for that habitat. And when they don't have it, like in Antarctica, they will make tropical Africa inside, you know. They'll do anything to make it because that's the habitat we feel happy in. And we, unlike the chimps, which do not do that, they go to the edge of the Gombe forest and they go back because they love that habitat too, but they're comfortable in it. They don't try to change the world, and that is one of the biggest differences. And we do it because we have emotional success doing it before. We're incredibly tribal. These features that we deny are basically our biology, our biological heritage, and it's self-destructive. The idea that the humans are somehow going to never go extinct because we're smarter is, it's just political propaganda or prejudice. I mean, it's no basis whatsoever, in fact. So the question is the nature of the demise. And I think the first to go is the Geological Society and the Linnaean Society and Schubert and Beethoven and all the things that I personally think are valuable. They will be replaced by you just turn on the radio and you'll see what American bad jazz or something, I don't know. So it's the demise, the nature of the demise. I care about the nature of the demise, but I don't predict it because I don't think I have any basis for prediction.
Mm. So you're not massively optimistic about...
Well, it's a question of time scale. Mm. It's a question of time scale.
It's a very frustrating business for me at the moment. You see, in many ways, I am a green. I started off as a green. And Rachel Carson's story, I think she was the founder in many ways of the modern green movement. But she was interested in nature and wildlife and all the rest of it. She was concerned about birds being poisoned with the injudicious use of pesticides by farming. She wasn't scared about that some minute, a few billionths of a picogram of DDT in her food would give her cancer. And that is the kind of thoughtless lack of proper scientific consideration that you get in the green movement. And I deplore it. As a green, they're doing nearly as much harm in every way to the world as the polluters.
Is that perhaps because of not such an awareness of science and how key science is to the future?
Partly, yes, it is. I think we're not going to stop global warming. Because as an animal, we're not yet developed enough to be able to work together. I mean, we're tribal animals, and always the male side, or technically side, love battles. They won't admit it, but they have football matches as substitutes. But it's there in us. We can't help it. We evolve that way. And war is a powerful driver of new ideas. You want new weapons, and that leads to new science.
And do you think maybe it's affected thinking as well, talking about sort of survival of the fittest and reproduction and survival of the species rather
I think so. And as global warming gets worse, it'll become more and more of a situation, I think, like a wartime situation, where it's affecting everybody, and they say, right, we've got to do something. I mean, one thing that will happen that happened in war is a temporary suspension of democracy. You know, they can't afford the arguments. We've all got to work together.
Some people have sort of argued that maybe scientists should have more power in that way, and running the show, is that something you think would help? Or
no, I don't. I think Churchill put it very well. Scientists should be on tap, but never on top. I find it very funny. I read The Economist quite a bit, just out of interest, and you'll see in it great articles on what we must do to stop climate change and things like renewable energy and all the rest of it. And then turn a page and you'll come to great new discoveries of oil. This will so improve the economy. And you can't have it both ways.
Yeah.
And we'd never seem to understand. I mean, they talk about the huge emissions of carbon dioxide from America. If you go there and look, you find what it is. It's because they've spread their cities out to an incredible extent. People have to drive up to 100 miles to work, that kind of thing. And they drive in rather inefficient cars. But they can't do anything else. They can't just stop driving them. It's not a kind of wickedness and overindulgence. It's just the way things have happened. Guilt is quite inappropriate.
Hmm.
Well, it always is, personally.
So long as we do something now,
yes,
we shouldn't feel bad about the past.
It's what you do afterwards that matters.
So do you have quite an optimistic outlook, then, in terms of the future?
Yeah, very.
You think we'll somehow manage to work it out?
Oh, sure. Yes, I'm quite optimistic. We've got to be, because I think we're a very important animal.
James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis were both speaking at Life and the Planet, held at the Geological Society in May, and sponsored by the Natural Environment Research Council. You can view some of the presentations from that meeting on the Geological Society's website. In the next episode, we look at the science behind carbon capture and storage and ask, is the Earth entering a new geological epoch?